coming up on Economics Explored.
What's distinctive of critical thinking is that critical attitude that one takes to one's own reasons and also to the principles or methods one's relying on in drawing inferences on the basis of what one understands. So critical reasoning is very much connected up with what Descartes would have called the method of doubt, right? Subjecting what one believes, you know, to doubt and, you know, in order to establish a better foundation for one's belief and really being careful about the foundations for one's belief.
Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist based in Brisbane, Australia, and I'm a former Australian Treasury official. This is episode 123 on truth and critical thinking with philosophy professor Deb Brown, director of the Critical Thinking Project at the University of Queensland here in Brisbane. Critical thinking skills are obviously as important in economics as in other fields. My colleague Tim Hughes and I had an incredible conversation with Deb, which ran for nearly 2 hours. She delivered a heap of great insights into the nature of truth and critical thinking. I've split the recording into two, and this episode contains the first half of our conversation. I'll play the rest of it in the coming weeks. Please stick around to the end of the episode where I'll summarise what I got out of it. Also, please check out the show notes for links to materials mentioned in this episode and for any clarifications. I'll spell out the small number of abbreviations that Deb uses and I'll provide background on some of the issues that we discuss, such as Australia's new AUKUS nuclear submarine pact with the US and the UK. Also, I'll include a note about the Trump-Trudeau argument over whether the US has a trade deficit with Canada, to clarify one of the things that we chat about with Deb. If you're a regular listener or you've studied economics, I expect that you'll guess what that clarification is about while listening. You can find the show notes via your podcasting app or at our website, economicsexplored.com. Please consider getting on our email list via the website as you'll be notified of new episodes and any new videos or articles. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions relating to this episode or to previous ones, then please either record them in a message via SpeakPipe, see the link in the show notes, or email them to me via contact@economicsexplored.com. I'd love to hear from you. Righto, now for our conversation with Professor Deb Brown on truth and critical thinking. Thanks to my audio engineer Josh Krotz for his assistance in producing this episode. I hope you enjoy it. Professor Deborah Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Deborah. So we spoke with one of your colleagues.
Hang on, I'm going to jump in there. Sorry.
Sorry.
No, do you prefer Deb?
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Yeah, because you said Deborah.
Oh, yes. Oh. Yeah, okay. Well,
I thought because you're down as being Deb, so I imagine that you preferred that.
Yes.
Well, people only call me Deborah when they're mad at me.
Not okay. A good start.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, Deb, thank you. And I've got Tim here with me, Tim Hughes, my regular fairly regular co-host on the show. So, Tim, good to have you on this again. So,
thanks, Gene. Good to be here.
Excellent. Okay, so, Deb, we're keen to chat with you about this issue of truth and how do we know what's true. We spoke with John Atkins about this on the program toward the end of last year. So he's a colleague of yours in the philosophy school at University of Queensland, or the School of Philosophy and Historical Inquiry?
Historical and Philosophical Inquiry.
Historical and Philosophical Inquiry. Great. Yep.
Happy.
Ah, very good. Okay. So we chatted with John about that and you're keen to continue that conversation, that exploration of how do we know what's true, because it's relevant to economics. It's and this is something we've learned during the pandemic, that there's just so much debate about what the facts are and what's true, and it makes it difficult for anyone really to understand what's going on or to provide their own opinions. I mean, as economists, we've got views on economic policy, but it's difficult when you don't even know what the core facts are. So they're the sort of things we want to chat about. And
there was an article that you were quoted in an ABC News article, and this is how we found out about the work you're doing. It was an article about politicians and the truth, and I think the article had an interesting title, "Is Telling the Truth Too Much to Ask of Our Politicians?" And you made some great observations in that, and I think it was Tim who discovered it. Tim, what was it in that article that you reacted to and made you think that it would be good to chat with Deb about this article?
Yeah, I mean, it was right along the lines of what we'd been talking about a lot between ourselves last year, and then with that episode with John Atkins, which was great. And so it's one of the prevalent issues that we face anyway, and especially in these times of pandemics, et cetera. So I certainly got drawn in by the title, "Is Telling the Truth Too Much to Ask of Our Politicians," which we will discuss in a few moments. But also further down, where it was mentioned, Deb, about the work that you're doing with the UQ, where were I? UQ Critical Thinking Project, which I'm really interested in to hear more about, and so we'll go into some of that as well. That project helps students and teachers embrace critical thinking. So I thought that was a great solution. We've been talking in terms of, like, you know, how can we do this better? That's always been the emphasis of whatever we've been talking about. It's like there are clearly issues, and you know, how do we find out the truth, or how do we, you know, trust a news source, etc. And so to break that cycle, because we weren't taught this in school, to break that cycle, to have something which are involved with the Critical Thinking Project sounded great. So there were several driving factors, yes, to ask you to come on this episode, and we're very very pleased that you took up the invitation.
Absolutely. So to begin with, Deb, could I ask, what is the basis for your position on politicians and the truth? So you take a very strong position, don't you? You take a position that politicians shouldn't lie under any circumstances. Could you take us through your thinking there, please?
I'm sort of really coming from the perspective of political philosophy there. And if you think about the relationship between, you know, a public or citizens and an elective official, really what's going on there, and this kind of goes back to sort of early theories of the state, like you would find, for example, in Thomas Hobbes, is fundamentally a transfer of authority, or, you know, I mean, to put it in sort of political economy terms, you know, the public is, you know, the principal, and, you know, they transfer a kind of electoral agency to an elected official. And the notion of authority derives from the same root as authorship. So it's connected with these ideas of having a voice and representing oneself. So insofar as one is an author of one's own actions, one is speaking for oneself. But in electing an official, one transfers some of that authority to speak for oneself, to represent oneself, to another person. And it's fundamental for the legitimacy of that relationship that the agent, that's, you know, elected or whatever, the politician, you know, therefore upholds the very highest standards of truth, right? Because in a sense, when they speak, you know, they speak for us all, we all speak. And so when they lie, we all lie. And, you know, it's at some fundamental level of analysis, because of that relationship. And the issue is, I mean, to go back to the kind of principal-agent analogy as well, I mean, in any principal-agent relationship, there's always, as you would know as economists, an information asymmetry, right? So the agent has information, is making decisions on the basis of information that isn't easily accessible by the principal. And so when you add lying or bullshit to that mix, you've got the kind of Molotov cocktail of an agency problem, right? Because it's, you know, because then, you know, the citizenry don't really know, you know, who to trust. And I think it doesn't just kind of confine itself to that relationship between, you know, the public and an elected official. It actually spills over into a general culture of mistrust. So I don't think it's disconnected, for example, from the problems that we're facing now, where there's widespread mistrust in you know, in medical, you know, researchers or about climate science. And like you were saying earlier, Tim, in relationship to, you know, to those issues about, you know, about what information out there you can trust. I mean, what are the facts and you know, how can you, you know, how can you verify them? How can you verify the sources of those informations and so on? So I think that's the broader issue, is that it feeds into a general culture of mistrust, which has enormous consequences for everybody.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I was just thinking about it with politicians. I mean, I think that largely where politicians lie, they are held accountable. And I mean, we can think of some famous examples. I mean, Anthony Eden in the Suez crisis, who lied in the parliament about the actions of the British and the French, and might have been Israel as well, in their conspiracy regarding the Suez. And I mean, Anthony Eden paid the price. He had to resign. And Richard Nixon, another example. So ultimately, I mean, I think it's about the mechanisms, because unfortunately there is this, it's often in their political interest to lie or to mislead and to cover things up. And I mean, more current examples, I mean, you've got Tony Blair, who's been given a knighthood, and there's now outrage about that, because there are a lot of people who think he misled the public about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that led to the war. But I mean, his reputation's been destroyed. So yeah, I'm just trying to figure this out. I mean, I think, do you think politicians are lying more now than ever before? And perhaps they are, and I mean, they're not being held accountable, because no one believes what the truth is. No one knows what the truth is. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, in a way, it's a kind of empirical question, you know, whether lying is more prevalent and whether people are getting away with it more. And I'm not in a position to really speak to that. But I do think that you know, that as the standards of truth are eroded or degraded, that it becomes easier to lie. And I think what is happening is that bullshit is much more prevalent than it used to be. And bullshit is in a special category of its own, right? So the distinction between lying and bullshitting is that the liar is somebody who knowingly utters what they believe to be false with the intention to deceive. But there is, at least in the case of lying, there is some, you know, kind of acknowledgement of, you know, the difference between what's true and what's false, right? So in a sense, the liar is somebody who is at least paying attention to the truth or the falsity, as the case may be. But the bullshitter is somebody who, you know, just says whatever is expedient, right? Whatever is advantageous at the time that they utter it. And that disregard for truth is in a way more pernicious than lying. This is a point that was made by Harry Frankfurt in his book on bullshit, which I think is one of the kind of classics of philosophy.
Right.
I think we've seen a lot of that in America. We're starting to see it here. And again, if you've got a culture where people are really confused about what constitutes a fact or the higher standards of truth, then you can get away with a lot more of it, you know? And that I think is really dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of the problem is that there aren't any trusted media sources anymore that can evaluate these different claims. And so one side just says, oh, well, that's fake news. And I mean, former President Trump would say that a lot of the things said about him, oh, that's all fake news, and yeah, don't trust CNN or don't trust whoever. And look, and CNN is probably guilty of exaggerating many things, as the other side, Fox News, are. But then you've got people dividing into different camps and just believing one side of the media. So it just becomes incredibly difficult to figure out what's going on. But when was that, on that book on bullshit, when was that published, Deb?
Oh, sorry, I can't remember.
It was 2005.
Okay, so it's, yeah.
Okay,
so it's, a,
yeah. In it's the, relatively, thanks, Tim.
Right, and yeah, I'm just trying to think, and what were the examples that he gave in there? Can you remember any of the examples?
Can I remember any of the examples? I mean, he did give political examples, but interestingly, I mean, he also drew on historical sources, like, for example, Saint Augustine. So Saint Augustine wrote two treatises on lying. One was De Mendatio and the other was Contra Mendatium, on lying and against lying. And you know, Augustine makes a number of, you know, subtle distinctions between the various kinds of lying and, you know, the differences between uttering falsehoods, knowingly uttering falsehoods, knowingly uttering falsehoods with the intention to deceive. And so you kind of have increasing levels of you know, moral harm, if you like.
Yeah.
Depending on what type of lying you have there. And you know, Augustine makes, I mean, I think one of the issues that people often have with debates about lying is there's this very kind of natural tendency to assume, look, everybody lies, right? So, you know, you lie to your kids about the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus, whatever it is, or, you know, you lie to, you know, to sort of not, you know, draw attention to some, you know, obvious problem or, you know, issue with a friend, you know, all these kinds of the white lies, right? Mm. And interestingly, I mean, Augustine and Frankfurt picks up on this, is that Augustine has a nice distinction between lying and being a liar, right? And so these occasional lies, which are often motivated, again, it really matters what kind of intention is at work here. The, you know, the kind of white lie is often motivated by an intention to, you know, to protect another from harm or to, you know, to help out another person, right? But, you know, but when the lying is self-motivated, you know, when it's to one's own personal advantage, right, that's when it starts to get bad. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, that's what we're seeing politically, right? I mean, we're seeing lying that is purely motivated by political advantage. And that's where it gets problematic.
I see. Can I jump in there? Because there's a couple of really good points that you make there, Deb. One of them is trust, which I'd like to go back to because I think it's such a big area and such an influential area in everything that comes next.
We were talking about the different levels of lying, and I mean, you were talking about Saint Augustine, weren't you? And then it depends on your intention. But the problem is now we've just got politicians. That's just their standard operating mode, isn't it? Just to BS all the time. And that's one of the problems we've got. And yeah, I think that probably has increased. And it's interesting that this book that came out in 2005, so he'd already noticed this, that politicians were doing this. And it's 2x or 3x or 10x what it was back then, even in 2005 now. I mean, if you think about what's happened in the last 15 years relative to where we were, 17 years now, relative to 2005. So yeah, that's really, it's a good point. I'll have to check that book out. I think Tim's got his...
I was just going to say, so Tim, you were asking earlier about an example, or maybe it was Eugene, sorry.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, a kind of classic example from recent political history is when Donald Trump was having a meeting with Justin Trudeau and accused Canada of having a trade deficit with the US. And Justin Trudeau said, you know, no, we don't. You know, you're wrong. Speaking of facts. And Donald Trump just said, no, you're wrong. You know, you have a trade deficit with us. And then later on admitted publicly, I mean, it's actually filmed, you know, where he said, oh, I just made that up. So I mean that's a kind of classic example, or when a politician just, you know, assumes something to be the case. I mean, people often refer to Scott Morrison's comments about the Labor Party's electric vehicles policy. You know, we make comments like, oh, you know, you want to kill our weekend and drive petrol prices up. And, you know, without any evidence, was neither stated nor implied by the policy. And that's a kind of example of somebody, you know, you might have just been assuming it's true, but, you know, when you assume something to be true without the requisite information or evidence, and, you know, you're doing so in a context where it will appear advantageous to you or your party, whether you intend it or not, you know, you're bullshitting, right?
Yeah.
And so this is where I come back to it. So it did return. Intention was the other area. So intention and trust, they are intertwined, I guess. But for instance, where something on the page may read very differently as opposed to an occasion where you were actually at, and then you think from the page that looks quite harsh, or that could be interpreted very differently. Whereas the intention of the person in actuality, you know, in real life, was quite different. And so intention has such a big difference as to what comes next, as to how people might react. If the intention was good, then usually there's nothing, you know, it's a very different outcome as opposed to if the intention was bad. That has such an enormous impact, wouldn't you say, Deb?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, it's so relevant in legal cases as well. We judge people on the basis of their intentions. So people may make mistakes and, you know, we excuse those, right?
Yeah.
I guess one of the points I was making in the interview with the journalist for the ABC was that, you know, we are essentially rational beings, and what it is to be rational is to aim at the truth in our belief formation and aim at the good in our actions. And we can be wrong about the truth, and we can be wrong about what's good for us. But part of what it is to be rational is to at least aim for the truth, right? And to aim for the goodness in our actions. And of course, the goodness of our actions is dependent in part on the truth of our beliefs, right? So if we're mistaken, we're more likely in our action to have our actions misfire in various ways.
Yeah.
So the two are connected. So we, you know, so if somebody's mistaken, we, you know, we excuse them, right? If somebody lies, however, then the intentional factor comes in. If they omit the truth, right, and they omit the truth for personal advantage, right, again, the intention is what makes an omission wrong. I mean, it's an interesting question whether not saying anything can ever be a wrong. But if it's actually motivated by self-interest, then, you know, arguably it kind of it can be as bad as lying. I can also lie even when I don't say something false, or something I believe to be false, but merely imply it. Okay, so for example, if you ask me, you know, which is where I can get a bus into town, and I direct you to a busways, you know, stop that I know buses don't run to town through, then I haven't said, you know, I could say, you know, oh, go over there to the bus stop. I haven't said anything false, but I've implied something false, and so I might think I'm just as culpable as if I had said something false. So in each of these cases, it, you know, how we judge other people depends primarily on what kind of intention is involved.
Absolutely. And just before we go on to this critical thinking project, I'd just like to ask about, and this relates to the comments you made about how politicians do owe that there's a sacred bond or a sacred pact they've made with the voters that they have to tell the truth. One of the justifications that's often given for lying or covering things up is national security. And there's one perspective on the Kennedy assassination is that what the Warren Commission was about was trying to prevent a Third World War by covering up a lot of these inconvenient facts, you could call them, about Lee Harvey Oswald's connections and the involvement of other parties. I won't go into it because we could spend a whole 2 or 3 hours going to the Kennedy assassination. But one perspective on the Kennedy assassination is that there was a cover-up because they were worried that if this information got out in the community, that it could lead to pressure for the US to invade Cuba, and that could lead to a Third World War. And so there's this idea that, well, in some circumstances, there could be national security justifications for politicians. Well, I mean, I don't believe in lying. I think lying's terrible, but some people would argue there's a justification for covering up or maybe coming up with a cover story of some kind. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is national security an exception to this general principle you've put forth?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, empirically, I think it's often overused. So one can think about Rumsfeld during the lead up to the war on Iraq, where there wasn't evidence of weapons of mass destruction. When it all came out that there wasn't that evidence and that, you know, decisions had been made on other bases, you know, there was this claim, well, you know, absence of evidence doesn't entail, you know, evidence of absence. And, you know, which was just a kind of, you know, craziness in a way. I mean, if you've done a pretty comprehensive search and you could reasonably expect to find evidence if there was any, then evidence, you know, then absence of evidence is indeed evidence of absence. And, you know, one suspects that really what was going on there was sort of other national interests. So I think that kind of appeal to national interests is often abused. But I think one thing I did say in the article with the ABC was that, you know, there are going to be cases where, you know, lying or omitting the truth, you know, may well be justified. So you know, I think one of the things I said was, look, if you're hiding people in your house and the Nazis come to the door, go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, lie. But there it's not, you know, there it's not in your self-interest, right? And it's rather, you know, you're doing it to protect others. And you have to have very good information in that case, right? And it can't, you know, but what, I mean, I guess what's happening at the moment is so many lies just seem to be tied to, you know, concerns about getting re-elected or, you know, making the party look good. And, you know, like none of those have those kinds of, you know, bigger justifications in terms of national interests. And in fact, national interests can actually be, I think, harmed by, you know, by lying or omitting to tell the truth when it's morally appropriate to do so. And this actually goes back to your question earlier, Tim, about trust. So there's a wonderful philosopher, his name's David Gautier, and he wrote a wonderful book called Morals by Agreement, and he's very interested in the relationship between morality and advantage. He has another lovely smaller paper called Morality and Advantage. And what Gautier does in that paper is you know, distinguish between the prudent person, right, somebody who acts in their own self-interest, and the prudent and trustworthy person. And the difference between the two is that the prudent person is always going to act in their own self-interest. So they will enter agreements if agreements are in their self-interest, and they'll only stick with an agreement if it remains in their self-interest. Whereas the prudent but trustworthy person will enter an agreement and stick with it if it's rational to do so at the time they enter the agreement. And Gautier's argument is that the prudent and trustworthy person is going to be able to enter more beneficial agreements than the merely prudent person, because they can be trusted to hold to their agreement in a sense, you know, even if it doesn't in the end turn out to be advantageous to them. And I think what we've seen with the whole submarine deal with the French is that, you know, the consequence of that whole debacle and how that was managed is that the French, and, you know, for that matter, no other country, has a reason to enter an agreement with Australia unless it was in their immediate self-interest, and, you know, but would always have to bear in mind that we can't be trusted as a nation. So that's a case where it might look like that decision and, you know, withholding information from the French look like it might be in our national self-interest, but it isn't, right? Because now we're known to the rest of the world as a country that doesn't keep its agreements and can't be trusted. Right? So, you know, so truth, trust, you know, self-interest, it's all bound together.
And there's integrity wrapped up in that as well, isn't there? So to have integrity in those decisions and those choices, which goes back to, we've often talk about the Stoic philosophers and, you know, their four virtues of courage, wisdom, temperance, and
justice.
Thank you very much.
Justice.
And so integrity with all of this. And I think it's, you know, with the article that you did with the ABC, which was a really good article, by the way, it was really well reported by the ABC. I think it's fair enough that we should expect more from our politicians, that that we should expect a higher standard and more integrity. And we're getting used to the fact that the politicians do bend the truth or lie or bullshit or whichever variation in that spectrum of untruth that we may look at. And I wonder what might be a better example or something that we might be able to put in place to keep politicians accountable for their promises and to fact check as we go along, which again, the ABC does a pretty good job, but it's I think that should be front and center of our political news. It's like if someone has lied or misled or clearly made up something, then they need to be held accountable for that. And it shouldn't be accepted as being okay.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it's interesting that when, you know, when we put people on a stand, we ask them to, you know, to swear, to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. But we have only sort of an understanding that our politicians will, you know, will be transparent in their dealings and speak the truth. And, you know, and I know there have been, you know, there have been pushes to, you know, to at least get rid of lying in, for example, political advertising. And, you know, it would be an interesting test case to see how far, you know, even that will go. But, you know, but I think, you know, that we at least need, you know, as you say, a critical media to hold politicians to the highest standards of truth and justice and integrity, all those grand old virtues. And interestingly, I mean, I love the Stoics, and I also like their emphasis on heroic virtues, right? So, which is the kind of you know, apotheosis of the virtuous person is the one who has all of those virtues and also you know, is brave and you know has dignity and lives up to the dignity of their nature, dignity being, if you know, if not a classical virtue, then at least clearly aligned to it. And I think we need more discussions about what it is to act with dignity, and that is, you know, that will require that people you know, act for the sake of the public good. So what, you know, what defines the kind of classical hero, if you read somebody like the Stoic Marcus Aurelius, who was, you know, also an emperor, you know, what defines the, you know, this kind of heroic individual is primarily the fact that they act, you know, they act in all their dealings for the public good. It's that civic responsibility that defines them. You know, you can be a private, you know, moral citizen engaged in a life of contemplation, but you only reach the pitch of heroic virtue if you're geared towards the collective good and the public good, right? So that civic duty is fundamentally what drives and defines, you know, the hero in antiquity. Yeah. And I need more of that. And I was kind of amused by the comments in that article by Peter Beattie, because I remember, you know, from the days when Peter Beattie was premier, I was always really struck by the fact that he would say, yeah, you know, we stuffed up there, but we're going to fix it, right? And that kind of honesty, but also that commitment to correcting one's mistakes, you know, we're always sort of, you know, I always found that admirable, but more to the point, I found it sort of completely novel.
Yeah.
in Australian politics and politics internationally as well.
He was good at that. I mean, some people would have preferred that we didn't get to the stage where he had to say, I stuffed up. I mean, you could argue that some of these problems should have been addressed earlier on. But, yep, I agree with you. He was very good at that, and it was refreshing at the time. So if you're listening internationally, Peter Beattie was the Premier of the state of Queensland here in Australia. Dev, there's one thing I want to go back to on that comment you made about Iraq, and it's relevant to, well, one of the comments you make in the ABC article is relevant here. And it's this point about we should be talking about probabilities or our degree of certainty. And I think where they got into trouble, where the people who were pushing for the invasion of Iraq got into trouble, was that they weren't clear or they weren't honest about how much certainty they had in the information. And the classic example was you have Colin Powell going to the UN and was it George Tenet? And he said it's a slam dunk. They were just so confident that there were weapons of mass destruction, and that's therefore afterwards they couldn't then say, oh, well, the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. I mean, they were precluded from that line of argument because they were so confident, or they were saying this is for sure, whereas they should have been more honest about what the actual level of certainty is. Is that, that's along the lines of what you were saying in the article, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think if you're going to make strong kind of categorical claims, you know, then you want to have some basis for your confidence. And, you know, I mean, I think that people often get swept away by thinking, you know, looking not so much for reasons to believe some proposition, but rather reasons to have the belief, you know. So I think it was very prudent for them to be able to be confident in the belief that there were weapons of mass destruction. But those are the wrong reasons for believing, unless they're reasons that pertain to the truth of the proposition that there are weapons of mass destruction. And this is why, you know, we're so interested in reasoning and just trying to get a higher standard of reasoning along with a higher standard of truth in public life, as well as the society more broadly.
Oh, absolutely. Now, before you mentioned the media and how we do need a critical media, we absolutely agree. The problem is that we've got no one know, or that there's this division now, and we have media on the conservative side or the right side of politics. You have Fox News, and I mean, they've got a particular perspective. Then on the other side, well, I mean, arguably, well, you could say CNN, or maybe they veer more toward the Democratic side of politics in the US, MSNBC, and they're going to have their own perspective, and they might be really critical of Trump on if it's CNN, but they may end up embellishing things, and so there's just a lack of trust in these different sources. And. And it's difficult trying to figure out who's right, and I mean, and you can't do it by watching everything, because then you're just completely confused. Or I don't know, maybe that's what you need to do. That's why we're interested in your critical thinking project. I mean, how are you helping people in schools or young people, students? How are you helping them understand, like, how to discern the truth? Could you take us through the critical thinking project, please, Deb?
Sure. And I can actually even say something also about the media literacy issues as well. So I'll try and work up to that.
Great.
So, you know, just to kind of, you know, lay it out, I mean, we distinguish in philosophy between critical thinking, which, you know, so first of all, everybody thinks, right? But there is, you know, there's different levels in the quality of people's thinking. And, you know, what we do fundamentally is distinguish between critical thinking, which entails being able to evaluate the quality of one's own thinking. And so it's essentially metacognitive. It's, you know, it's about, you know, what reasons do I have to believe that? You know, does this evidence stack up? You know, what's the contradicting evidence? You know, sort of being disposed to look for not just evidence or reasons that support what you already believe, but actually looking for disconfirming evidence, right? You know, doing due diligence in the foundations for what one believes. And we distinguish that from other forms of thinking that don't concern the kind of quality of the foundations for one's beliefs. So these might be things like, you know, free association, or associative thinking. And that's very common. And often people mistake that for critical thinking. So associative thinking is where you're essentially looking, you know, you're selecting for information that supports what you already believe, right? And what you find then naturally coheres with what you believe. So we all sort of move around the world with these mental models. And the associative thinker will be looking for things that fit with their mental model, right? And in, you know, in science and in, you know, in other disciplines, this often is connected with what's called the confirmation bias, right? So that sort of, you know, preferencing confirming evidence over disconfirming evidence and so on. And it also passes, critical thinking is also distinguished from what we call careful thinking, which is where somebody might be, you know, applying rules or procedures. Think about, you know, a student in a class applying their procedural knowledge of mathematics, let's say, to, you know, to derive an answer or value on the basis of the arguments they have, you know. And that careful thinking, people often think they're being critical thinking when they're doing that as well. But what's distinctive of critical thinking is that critical attitude that one takes to one's own reasons and also to the principles or methods one's relying on in drawing inferences on the basis of what one understands. So critical reasoning is very much connected up with what Descartes would have called the method of doubt, right? Subjecting what one believes, you know, to doubt and, you know, in order to establish a better foundation for one's belief and really being careful about the foundations for one's belief. And a lot of what passes sort of, you know, in a child's education through school, you know, is either in that category of associative thinking or procedural knowledge. And they're often, you know, they will be asked to engage critically with material, but it's sort of divorced from the methods and reasoning of argumentation that are, if you like, the subject matter of philosophy. So, you know, so they might be told to sort of look for, you know, a reason for and a reason against. But critical thinking is really about being able to interrogate arguments. And once one can do that for oneself, one can then do it with others. And we also emphasize the collaborative nature of, you know, good reasoning environments and argumentation. Because if you go through the world, you know, in an echo chamber, just, you know, getting, you know, other people or information you find reflecting what you already believe, you don't get to reflect on all the cognitive biases and faulty heuristics and fallacies, you know, that you're prone to. And we're all naturally prone to, you know, to sort of faulty reasoning. And there's a lot of work done in cognitive psychology, particularly by characters like Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, which have been going on for decades. So they really documented just how prone to irrational thinking we are. But that sort of, that kind of descriptive project in psychology is different from what we're doing. We're saying, yes, that's the situation, but critical thinking is fundamentally a normative exercise, right? It's about teaching students the norms and methods of good reasoning so that they can be aware of these influences on them, the things that, you know, dispose them to certain kinds of faulty inferences. In the Australian context, critical and creative thinking is a general capability of the Australian National Curriculum. And so it's clearly an educational priority in Australia, as it is in every other jurisdiction in the world. It's what employers say they want. You know, if you survey employers as to what they think is the most important attribute of a graduate of university, critical thinking comes to the top of the pile, right? And then it's also part of, you know, the suite of 21st century skills. And it looks like one amongst many there, but it's actually foundational to all of those others. So if you can think critically and clearly, you can communicate clearly and effectively. If you can collaboratively reason with others, then you'll have better interpersonal skills. There's no innovation that doesn't depend on, you know, good analysis of problem space and, you know, problem solving and being able to draw good inferences and so on. Entrepreneurship is really just critical thinking contextualized to a business context, and I could go on and on and on. So critical thinking is kind of fundamental to all those so-called 21st century skills. And it's also an essential skill in, you know, in any knowledge economy, you know, any economy that depends on, you know, ideation, being able to anticipate problems, being able to solve problems and so on, is going to depend on people having good critical thinking skills. So that's the sort of context nationally, internationally. But there hasn't been a lot of advice to teachers as to how to integrate the teaching of critical thinking into their classroom practice. And teachers who are not trained in philosophy, which is most of them, will struggle to actually operationalize that general capability of critical and creative thinking. And so what, you know, my team is doing is essentially trying to help teachers unpack how to teach critical thinking you know, what kind of pedagogical knowledge they need in order to teach critical thinking and across the curriculum. So not teaching it as a standalone subject, but how you teach critical thinking in science, in math, in humanities, in English and so forth. And here, I have to have a big shout out to my brilliant colleague, Dr. Peter Ellerton, who really is an expert in these critical thinking pedagogies. And he's advising ACARA on, you know, how to rewrite the general capability and also advising the European Commission on critical thinking and STEM and so on. And so he's doing a lot of this work with teachers to help them kind of deliver in a more robust way that general capability of critical and creative thinking. You know, in the US, it's called, you know, part of the Common Core. In other countries, it's, you know, core concepts and so on. So it really is all over the world in terms of being an educational priority. And the other thing we do in the critical thinking project, so we have this project going with teachers. We offer them professional learning in teaching for thinking, as we call it. And we also work with the Queensland Government Department of Education's Impact Centre. And the Impact Centre is an online extension course provider to provide standalone critical thinking courses to students online anywhere in the state of Queensland. And they partner with over 350 schools in Queensland and have some international interests as well in what they're doing. And what we've seen from teaching students critical thinking from grade 4 all the way to grade 10 is that, you know, you see dramatic gains both academically in terms of NAPLAN scores and across all areas of NAPLAN. But you also see these other cognitive gains as well. To go back to Tim's point earlier about virtues, you see students demonstrating these virtues of open-mindedness, resilience, the resilience to change their mind if, you know, on the basis of better reasons or evidence. And that's really fundamental. A critical thinker is somebody who is able to say, you know, oh, I was wrong about that. Or I used to think this, but listening to Rosie, you know, I now think her reasons are better than mine, and, you know, and switching their beliefs. And that's the gold seam in this project, is when you can have students feel comfortable about changing their mind. When they can identify, construct, and evaluate arguments, right? They can measure what people are saying against standards of correctness, you know, logical standards, like the standards of valid arguments and sound arguments and so on. They're able to tell you in grade 6 what the difference between a deductive and inductive argument is. You know, I mean, this is huge, and it's kind of a bit of a revolution in Queensland. You know, we've got, as I said, 350 schools plus engaging with the Impact Centre courses. We've had over 1,000 teachers go through our training. We've done training in California, Vancouver, Singapore, Europe, South Africa. You know, I mean, you know, we're sort of getting all this traction in other states as well within Australia. It's not just confined to Queensland, but Queensland is, if you like, the kind of, you know, early adopting test case for the whole project. And it's been going for 10 years, and it's, you know, we're seeing these significant gains. And we also do a lot of work with low SES communities and also low SES students. We're really trying to shift the dial in terms of getting students into university, but not just getting them into university, but really supporting them once they're there. And so we offer to low SES students a course called Effective Thinking and Writing in year 11. And it's an intensive course, and it prepares them for, you know, for the kind of academic thinking and writing they'll need to do once they get to university. And the data from that course alone is, you know, just blows our mind. I mean, so we see students who are coming in from low SES schools into that course. They enter that course at a lower starting point than other students coming into other such courses offered through the University of Queensland, and they are outperforming on average students once they get to university. They have higher retention rates, they have higher completion rates within 3 years, and they have higher GPAs. Courses like that really do shift the dial on low SES and remote and rural and regional engagement with universities.
That sounds fantastic, Deb. Really good.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking in responding to some of the things you've said there, this point about open-mindedness and being willing to change your mind is so important. And the people who, you know, manage large amounts of money, so I'm thinking of Ray Dalio, who's one of the top hedge fund managers in the world, who's worth, I don't know, $4 or $5 billion or whatever. And he wrote this great book a few years ago, Principles. And he says, yes, that's one of our principles. We have to be radically open-minded and be willing to change our minds, to think about a wide range of facts, to evaluate how reliable different sources of information are, how reliable are even grading their own colleagues on how reliable or how accurate they've been in their analysis or predictions in the past. It's a fascinating approach, and I think it's so important. How much of this is do you instill the idea of the scientific method? Is scientific method a part of this education, Deb?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, within the University of Queensland, we work with educators from science faculty, from engineering, from health and behavioural sciences, from biomedical sciences, you know, all over the place. Because I myself have an Australian Research Council grant with a neuroscientist where we're investigating, really interrogating arguments that are presented in debates about animal consciousness. So, you know, so those sort of collaborative, in that collaborative engagement we have with, you know, STEM areas is proving to be really fruitful. And if, you know, if I may sort of just wax lyrical a bit about, you know, the history of philosophy for a moment as well. I mean, I think it's really interesting to sort of reflect on where we are in the academy nowadays compared to where the academy was, you know, back when universities were first being formed. And if you think about the early great universities at, you know, Paris and Oxford and Bologna and so on, the first year of a university degree was devoted entirely to logic on the not unreasonable assumption that if you can't think, there's really not much point in you going on, right?
Yeah,
makes sense.
And what's happened with the specialisation of the disciplines that occurred, you know, starting in the 19th century, but has, you know, really dominated, you know, universities in the 20th and 21st century is that you get these disciplines being separated off from philosophy. So philosophy becomes, you know, one subject area that you can take, you know, like history or, you know, engineering or whatever it might be. And that's been a problem for, you know, for philosophy departments, and philosophy as a discipline. You know, we only have whatever it is, 7 or 8 people in our group at UQ, for example. But it's also been a problem for all those other disciplines, right? Because they are not being trained in, you know, in these methods and norms of reasoning and argumentation that are the specialization of philosophy. I mean, philosophy doesn't have a subject matter other than that, right? I mean, there's, you know, all different branches and subfields of philosophy, you know, philosophy of science, philosophy of art, you know, ethics and so on. But what they have at their core, you know, are those methods of analysis and reasoning and so on. And when you kind of cut students off from that and you cut, you know, and those students then go on to be academics in other fields, they themselves are not trained in critical thinking or argumentation. And so, you know, so that has all sorts of flow-on effects and negative consequences for those other disciplines. And the people who are engaging with us, you know, from these other disciplines are saying, you know, our students don't get this, right? They don't have, you know, enough logic, or they don't, you know, understand critical thinking, or they don't see how that's a core part of the scientific method, right? So, you know, whether you're relying on inductive techniques in science or whether you're relying on hypothetico-deductive models, you know, where you're proposing a hypothesis and then seeking, for example, to disconfirm the null hypothesis, you know, I mean, all of those kind of, you know, pictures of scientific reasoning have all been developed by philosophers, particularly philosophers of science, you know, like Popper and Reichenbach and so on.
Well, that's back to Descartes' method of doubts, yeah? It's the same.
Yeah, and of course, they all go back to Descartes as well, right? You know, if you want to believe something, doubt it first.
Yeah.
Right? But critical thinking is essential to the scientific method. One could just say, look, this is just critical thinking in a science context.
Yeah,
absolutely. Can I ask you about economics? Have you done any work with the School of Economics at all, Deb? Because economics is an area, a field where you could argue that, I mean, it can be taught in a way where there's no philosophy because it has been highly mathematical for decades now, and it's possible that you could go through and learn economics and even get a graduate degree in economics and not really understand philosophy. And as an economist, I found having some philosophy and having had some education in the philosophy of science and how that relates to economics, I recalled some of these things, and it's helped me not be as doctrinaire or dogmatic about some things during the pandemic as some other economists. So I can go into that a bit later, but I was just wondering if you've done any work with economics or have any thoughts on economics and how that can be improved by philosophy.
Myself, I haven't done any work with economists. So I have worked with people from the business school at the University of Queensland. My colleague, Dr. Julian Lamont, has done a lot of work in philosophy and economics, and he works with economists around the place, including at UQ. And he's an expert in things like economic rents and CEO pay and takes this kind of distributive justice lens. I've always admired his work. I think that what is essential in economics is just, you know, keeping in mind those virtues, including justice, right? And being particularly aware of the ethical implications. But also, critical thinking and logical analytic skills, are needed there. One of the biggest problems across all, domains of research, I'm finding more and more, I'm sort of starting to kind of collect all these articles on reasoning problems across the various disciplines. And one of the biggest problems concerns, inferential capacities. Like what can you infer on the basis of the data you have? What can you reasonably infer on the basis of the data you have? And often there's a problem, about people sort of inferring or reading too much into the data. That's a very common problem. And I think training in critical thinking, if I was God, I would make critical thinking essential for all university students. I would make it core. I would bring back the 1 year of logic to the curriculum.
What about statistics too? Because I think a lot of the problems we're getting into, in some cases, it's not understanding statistics or misunderstanding just how much confidence we can have in a particular set of numbers or outcomes we see. So.
Absolutely. Particularly the base rate fallacy. There's a kind of pandemic of base rate fallacies. And you see this particularly, for example, in how COVID deaths are being reported. People say, there were 140 people in the ICU with COVID and only 39 of them were unvaccinated, And it's like, well, let's bear in mind the percentage of unvaccinated people in the population, and then you get a somewhat different picture about the likelihood of ending up in the ICU, if you're unvaccinated as opposed to vaccinated. So, yeah, if I was God, I would have, statistics as a core course as well. Can I be God on this show?
Get my vote, Deb.
God
for a day. I just need a day.
Okay, we'll pause it there and I'll bring the rest of it to you in a future episode. Hasn't it been a great conversation with Deb so far? I must say that I loved it. My main takeaway is the importance of metacognition, thinking about thinking, and evaluating the quality of our own thinking. This is something that I'm increasingly trying to do as I attempt to live up to Ray Dalio's example of being radically open-minded. We should really question why we believe what we do. Don't just look for evidence which backs your beliefs, but deliberately seek out evidence which could shatter those beliefs to make sure that you're on solid ground. This is something that Tim and I are both very interested in doing, and we'll aim to come back for a deeper conversation on metacognition and how we can operationalize it in a future episode. Righto, that's all I have to say for now, so stay safe and go well.
Okay, that's the end of this episode of Economics Explored. I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please tell your family and friends and leave a comment or give us a rating on your podcast app. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, you can feel free to send them to contact@economicsexplored.com and we'll aim to address them in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Till next week, goodbye.